So this is August 15th, 2010, and the title of my talk, I guess, can be Stumbling on Happiness. A lot of the material I'm going to use comes from a book of that with that name by a guy named Daniel Gilbert. He's a psychologist at Harvard and a researcher on happiness. And this book here, Stumbling on Happiness, actually, Cecily bought it and gave it to Roshi. She wrote, "Roshi, for the next time you just can't think of another Taisho topic," and I've stolen it. But I told him he's okay. He says he has a lot of material. We'll see. So what I want to do, what I want to accomplish in this talk, and God knows if I will or not, is to take a good look at how little we know ourselves as far as what will make us happy. And then I want to expand on that with the implications for Zen practice. And there's a lot of things about practice that have been on my mind recently with all the exciting events in the world of Zen. So let's sort of dig in here. The naive point of view that most of us come into the world with, or actually we don't come in this way, but we pick it up pretty quickly, is to think that our thoughts and feelings are an unfiltered version of reality. We're inside our heads and we're looking out at this physical world that exists just the way we think we see it, and often we feel just the way we feel it. But it's pretty easy to demolish that point of view. And one of the really nice demonstrations that Gilbert uses is to have us take a look at the blind spot in both of our eyes. You know, the optic nerve comes out of the back of the eye and heads off to the brain where it works its magic. And at that spot on the retina where the hookup is, you can't see anything. No light can be reflected off of there that you can see because you have no rods or cones. That spot is taken up with heavy-duty cabling. So if you, and there's a little example that he has in the book where you have a picture of a magician holding a rabbit, and then off to the side there's a little circle. Maybe I think it's the Earth seen from space. And if you close one eye, and you can all do this right now, close an eye, and then if you take this piece of paper and bring your nose up to the bunny, as you move towards it, the little circle, the Earth, will disappear. If you've never done this before, you should do it. It's just astounding. And that means that when you have one eye closed and you're looking at the room, there is a hole. There is a hole with nothing there. You need to have the right setup to discover this hole because your brain is filling it in. It's amazing what our brains do so quickly that we have no idea that it's going on, but your brain is just sort of, it's like that computer tool where you can take a little bit of the surrounding picture and blend it into something that you want to cover over. You are editing out that blind spot and filling it in with whatever you think you're looking at. And you do it without thinking about it. It's happening all the time, and no one is really aware of it. There's another example, which is you can get a pair of glasses that makes the world appear to you upside down. And if you wear them for a few days, the world will turn right side up, and when you take your glasses off, the world will appear upside down. It's astounding, but it's true. This is how the mind works. It's continually, actively creating reality. And we are continually forgetting that it's doing that and believing that what we're seeing is something objectively out there, just as we see it. He has a bunch of other examples, basically of this phenomenon of filling in. You know, reality is incredibly ambiguous. Here's an example. You know, as you're reading a sentence in a book, each word makes sense and has meaning in context with other words. And until you get to the end of the sentence, you don't necessarily know what that context is. But you don't experience your reading as this disjointed, you know, okay, here's this word, what does it mean? Let me go on, let me find out, oh yeah, that's what it meant. you just read it smoothly because your brain is doing all that work in the background. So an example that he gives is if you say we were rowing in the pond and ran into a bank, you understand that immediately. And if you say I was walking down the street with my checkbook and ran into a bank, you also understand that. And you, if you, even if you reverse the sentence and say I ran into a bank while I was rowing my boat, you don't have that what did I mean by running into a bank. It just you naturally think you know. And they've done lots of little experiments to sort of bring this out. One example is they recorded a couple of sentences. One is the peel is on the orange, and the other is the heel is on the shoe. And right, instead of saying peel and heel, the person reading it just said eel. And then they inserted a little cough right in front, so the eel is on the shoe. And people listening to that cannot tell what letter is missing from the sentence because their mind has already filled it in. So our experience of reality is questionable at best. And then when we get into the higher level abilities that we have, like let's start with memory, things really, really get shaky. You know, everybody remembers things, and we don't really think much about it. I can remember stuff that happened to me in grade school, and it seems like I am going back and retrieving that event and replaying it in my mind. But in fact, what we know now quite clearly is what I remember is the last time that I remembered that particular incident. So every time you remember something, your mind throws together a few details, fills it in, and it's set in the brain. And then the next time you remember, you do the same thing, but you're not going back to the original event, you're going back to your memory. You just activate the memory, run it through, and lay it back down. And so anything you remember that's from 50 or, well, you may not be as old as me, from 10 or 20 years ago, if you've remembered it a number of times, it's not... you're not going back and actually remembering the real thing. You have this sort of crude picture that you're using. And memory is also extremely condensed. You know, if you truly remembered something in all the detail, your memory would take as long as the event took. So when you went to a concert, you would have to remember the entire concert. But instead, we remember it was kind of, I liked the way it started out at the end, but I thought that I started out at the beginning, but I thought the end was a little weak. You remember a dinner and you can think, well, the potatoes were overcooked, didn't like that so much, but the wine was really good. And you know, we were just remembering little details and then taking that for the actual event. And that's probably pretty clear to everybody with long-term memory, but then even short-term memory is extremely problematic. When Jon Kabat-Zinn was here back in 2006, I didn't see this, but I understand he ran this little clip. He instructed his audience, you know, you've got some people throwing a basketball back and forth. I want you to count how many times it's thrown back and forth, and then when the film is over, I'll have a question for you. So everybody watched, and there was a lecture on attentiveness, so people certainly paid attention. And then afterwards he said, okay, who saw the ape? Because during the film, somebody dressed in an ape suit had walked out right in the center of the screen, beaten his chest like this, and then walked away. And most people didn't see the ape because they were so busy counting the number of times the basketball was thrown back and forth. And then Gilbert has a great example where they send a researcher out to interview people. So they're in the middle of their interview, and the researcher has his pad and everything. And then all of a sudden, two really rude construction workers with a door sort of cut right in between the two of them. And then the interview continues. Well, what happens when that door goes by is the first interviewer ducks out along with the door, and a new interviewer who is behind the door appears. And most people have absolutely no idea that the person they're talking to has changed. which is, I would like to think that a Zen student would notice. But it all depends on what you're paying attention to. You know, if you're really absorbed in the questions being asked, you may not be really looking at the person. I remember my son Ivan, when he was a teenager, once dyed his hair green, and he was really upset when I had a conversation with him about something that I was upset about, and I didn't even notice that his hair was green. He'd gone to all this trouble to bother me, and I hadn't even noticed. So there's just so many things that we miss. When you're paying attention to one thing, you don't see something else. They've done experiments where they flash words on the screen with every other word capitalized. You know, so it's lowercase, uppercase, lowercase, uppercase. And then they have tracking software there. They can follow what your eye is doing, and everybody's eye is looking away several times a second. You know, the eyes sort of jiggle. And so they're able to, while the eye isn't looking, just swap the letters around. So now every word that was lowercase is uppercase. Everything that was uppercase is lowercase. No one notices. No one sees that. It's just invisible. Okay, so memory is a problem. But then what Gilbert really wants to get at is imagination, because this is, in a way, one of the most amazing things that the brain does. Let me just take a look in here. Rather than rely on my memory. Okay, so he says, if we want to know how a particular object looks when the object isn't sitting there in front of us, we send information about the object from our memory to our visual cortex, and we experience a mental image. Similarly, if we want to know how a melody sounds when it isn't currently on the radio, we send information about the object from our memory to our auditory cortex, and we experience a mental sound. So, for instance, if I ask you which syllable is the high note on in the tune Happy Birthday, for you to answer that, you'll have to run the song through your head. And you'll come up with an answer. You listen to it. They say listening with the mind's eye, but it's really you're listening with the mind's ear. And similarly with a penguin, I ask you to visualize a penguin and then tell me what's longer, his flippers or his feet. And you have your little picture of a penguin, and if you're like most people, you look at it and you say, oh, the flippers are longer than the feet. But you had to look. You know, you don't have that as a bare fact written out in your brain. You have this mental image, you can look at it, and you can find things out about it. And this is an extremely useful ability that human beings have. So he says, when our eyes and ears do not feed the visual and auditory cortices the information they require to answer the question we are asked, we request that the information be sent from memory, which allows us to take a fake look and a fake listen. And because our brains can do this trick, we are able to discover things about songs. The high note occurs on birth. And birds, the flippers are longer than the feet, even when we are all alone in a closet. He says, this use of the visual and auditory areas to execute acts of imagination is a truly ingenious bit of engineering and evolution, and evolution deserves the Microsoft Windows Award for installing it in every one of us without asking permission. But then he goes on from that, and he says, this imaginary process that allows us to discover how a penguin looks even when we are locked in a closet is the same sort of process that allows us to discover how the future will feel when we're locked in the present. So this is something we do all the time. This is where he's really getting into why are we stupid about what will make us happy. So when we try to decide on some course of action, we imagine it happening, and then we think about how that makes us feel. So, for instance, if I ask you, how would you feel if the postman was having an affair with your wife? You imagine that, you get a bad feeling, and you say, I would be devastated, or I would be relieved, or whatever your reaction is. But As he points out, there are some problems with this. And the first is the principle of primacy. The brain is wired to pay attention to what's actually going on and not to things that happened in the past or the future. So if you are looking at an ostrich and I ask you to imagine a penguin, you're very likely to want to close your eyes in order to do that. And you see this people doing this all the time. When they want to remember something, they close their eyes. In fact, when you ask them to sit with their eyes open, they resist, as I found out at Chautauqua. But it's even more of a problem when you try to imagine how you're going to feel about something, because your mind is going to first pay attention to how you feel right now. And so you get the phenomenon of somebody who's quite angry being unable to imagine that they would enjoy a string quartet tomorrow. They're too absorbed in their present feeling to really be able to project that feeling in the future. And we have this sort of bias that's with us all the time, where whatever is going on in the present colors our projection, our imagination of what will happen in the future. There's actually a term for this. It's called presentism. I think the term was first used in connection with history. So this is why we're all sort of aghast that Thomas Jefferson had slaves, because we judge him by the standards of the present. It's shocking that people in 1923 weren't wearing seatbelts. What were they thinking about? But it becomes even more of a problem when we try to imagine the future, because we always think the future is going to be just a slightly changed version of the present. We always start from where we are and then make a few changes, and that's our picture of tomorrow. And, of course, the most dramatic place to see this is to go to Disney World and go to Tomorrowland. The Tomorrowland that was created back in the 50s or 60s, I think, was supposed to be taking place about now. And things are not really very much like the Jetsons today. And there's all sorts of things that have happened that they missed, including cell phones and rap music and the good and the bad. Not that both of those aren't good, of course, or both of those aren't bad. Difficulty that I've already talked about is this whole issue of knowing how we're going to feel. And he has a word for this, which is pre-feeling. It says, pre-feeling often allows us to predict our emotions better than logical thinking does. So they did a study, and researchers offered volunteers a reproduction of an impressionist painting or a humorous poster of a cartoon cat. And before making their choices, some volunteers were asked to think logically about why they thought they might like or dislike each poster. These are the thinkers. And others were encouraged to make their choices quickly and from the gut. And these are the non-thinkers. So we're always told, of course, by career counselors and financial advisors that we should think long and hard when you want to make a sound decision. But what the researchers found when they phoned the volunteers later and asked them how much they liked their new objet d'art was that the thinkers were the least satisfied. Rather than choosing the poster that had made them happy when they imagined hanging it in their homes, they had ignored their pre-feelings and instead chosen posters that possessed the qualities which a career counselor or financial advisor would approve. The olive green in the Monet may clash with the drapes, whereas the Garfield poster will signal to visitors that I have a scintillating sense of humor. Non-thinkers, on the other hand, trusted their pre-feelings. They imagined the poster on their wall, noted how they felt when they did so, and assumed that if imagining the poster on their wall made them feel good, then actually seeing it on their wall would probably do the same. And they were right. Pre-feeling allowed non-thinkers to predict their future satisfaction more accurately than thinkers did. And indeed, when people are prevented from feeling emotion in the present, they become temporarily unable to predict how they will feel in the future. And I won't go into it, but this is one of the really interesting things about the case of this guy, Phineas Gage, who had a rod shot through his head back in the 19th century and was really unable to make decisions after that. Even though no other part of his brain was affected, he no longer was able to access his emotional decision-making function. So pre-feeling is really, really useful. We need it in order to make decisions. We make decisions using our emotions. But it's also extremely sketchy and extremely limited. He says, he talks about the business of the brain having strict priorities about what it'll see, hear, and feel, and what it will ignore, and the primacy of whatever is going on in the present moment. So imagination's requests are often denied. Both the sensory, that is, seeing and hearing, and emotional systems, which is feeling, enforce this policy, and yet we seem to recognize when the sensory systems are turning down imagination's request. You know, I can tell right now that because I'm looking at Errol, I'm not able to imagine Scott very well. But they fail to recognize when the emotional system is doing the same. So when looking at an ostrich and imagining a penguin and failing to do it, we never become confused and mistakenly conclude that the large bird with the long neck that we are currently seeing is in fact the penguin that we were attempting to imagine. One of the hallmarks of a visual experience is that we can almost always tell whether it is the product of a real or an imagined object. But not so with emotional experience. Emotional experience that results from a flow of information that originates in the world is called feeling, and if it results from a flow of information, then they're calling it pre-feeling. And mixing them up, he says, is one of the world's most popular sports. So one little experiment they did is they called up people living in different cities in the United States and asked them how satisfied they were with their lives. And then they looked at what the weather was like in each of those cities. And lo and behold, the people living in cities that were experiencing lousy weather were not as satisfied with their lives as the people where the weather was good. So when people tried to imagine how they felt about their lives, it was colored over with how they felt in the moment. Going back to my son, I remember him during his darkest days as a teenager telling me that his entire childhood had been miserable. And I couldn't talk him out of it, but I remembered a kid who laughed and enjoyed his life quite a bit. He had tough times too, of course, very tough times, but it was just sort of striking that his entire past was colored with the feelings of his teenage angst, let's say. It's a hallmark of depressed people that they just can't imagine feeling anything other than the depression they have. You know, that trite saying, this too will pass, is true, but it's very hard to believe when you're in the middle of any strong emotion. And they did lots of other experiments. They asked people whether if they became lost while they were hiking, and had neither food nor water, what would be the biggest problem? Would it be hunger or would it be thirst? And the people they asked after having exercised on a treadmill, the thirsty group, 92% of them felt that thirst would be the biggest problem, whereas with everybody else, only 61% thought that would be the biggest problem. So again, we always take our cue from where we're at, even though those results are inevitably inaccurate. He says, say you've had an awful day. The cat peed on the rug. The dog peed on the cat. The washing machine is busted. World wrestling has been preempted by Masterpiece Theater, and you naturally feel out of sorts. If at that moment you try to imagine how much you would enjoy playing cards with your buddies the next evening, you may mistakenly attribute feelings that are due to the misbehavior of real pets and real appliances to your imaginary companions. I don't think I'll go because Nick always ticks me off. We can't feel good about the future when we're busy feeling bad about an actual present, but rather than recognizing that this is the inevitable result of the reality first policy, that is the policy of the brain, we mistakenly assume that the future event is the cause of the unhappiness we feel when we think about it. Our confusion seems terribly obvious to those who are standing on the sidelines saying things like, "You're feeling low right now because Pa got drunk and fell off the porch, Ma went to jail for whooping Pa, and your pickup truck got repossessed. But everything will seem different next week, and you'll really wish you decided to go with us to the opera." At some level, we recognize that our friends are probably right. Nevertheless, when we try to overlook, ignore, or set aside our current gloomy state and make a forecast about how we will feel tomorrow, we find that it's a lot like trying to imagine the taste of a marshmallow while chewing liver. So we can see that, one, that pre-feeling is really, really necessary, and two, that it's really, really sketchy and unreliable. And so we're sort of in the situation of having poor tools and having to use them. And there are all sorts of decisions that we make and then wonder why things don't work out the way we tried to make them. One of the most obvious ones is our resolutions to to exercise more or to eat less. We make those resolutions when, for instance, let's take the eat less example, right after eating a huge dinner, when our gut is busting, it's easy to resolve, I'm not going to eat so much, I'm going to cut down. But what happens when we get to that future meal and we're absolutely starving? Lo and behold, our prediction of what we would do in the future has no relevance to our future self. The self that decided to exercise discipline is not the same as the self who is called upon to actually do it. And you'd think, okay, this is obvious to everyone, why should it be a problem? But the fact of the matter is, all of us are continually failing to follow through on what we intend to do. We're continually being distracted and pulled away. We're continually being seduced by short-term pleasure. If you don't think this is happening to you, then you're not looking hard enough. And I'm not going to offer you a solution right now, but I just want to throw it out there as something that anyone who's serious about working on themselves has to find a way to deal with. Here's another problem that we have when we imagine what things will be like. We always think that we're different from other people. So I could tell you that everybody overeats when they're hungry. Almost everybody tends to overeat when they're hungry. But you're going to think, no, I won't. You know, I can see the fallacy of doing that. Unfortunately, by thinking that you're different from other people, you're simply confirming how much like other people you are. As Gilbert says, if you're like most people, then like most people, you don't think you're like most people. We all think we're a special case. And so we'd much rather consult our own shaky memory and imagination to predict what we would do in certain circumstances rather than, say, asking a friend who's been there and done that, how'd it go for you? Because we know we're different from him. We're special. One of the reasons we feel special, of course, is because we have more information about our thoughts and feelings than we have about the thoughts and feelings of anybody else. You know, we're ready to write off somebody else's shoddy behavior as a moral failing, whereas we know with ourselves all the extenuating circumstances that led us to not clean the dish in the refrigerator or borrow somebody else's snack. We have this incredible self-bias that we're really unable to get away from very successfully. Here's another thing we do that we don't seem to be able to do much about, and that's worrying about things that don't happen. There's a movie written by David Mamet where one of the characters says, "Worry is interest paid on a debt that never comes due." Everybody has had the experience about worrying needlessly about something which is painful and unpleasant, and then having things turn out and the worry was totally needless. And yet, if you tell yourself, don't worry about it, this will be okay, it's very hard to do that because... Why is that? Why is that? Why is it so hard to set aside our worry? It's because we're emotionally blind. Once we're feeling that anxiety, we don't easily find a way out. We're not able to put down that feeling and imagine some other way of being. The only way you can change that is through some version, some sort of practice. It takes repeated doing. One of the wonderful things about learning to do Zazen, learning to stay in the moment and to pay attention to what's in front of you, is you begin to develop the ability to leave the emotion aside and pay attention to something else. You develop the ability to direct your attention where you want to put it. And that's a skill which can be used for good or for bad, but it certainly is a skill worth having. The other great virtue of practice is the ability to actually know what we're seeing, what we're reading. Everybody's had this experience where you're reading a book and the mind drifts away, and all of a sudden, you know, you're hearing birds chirping or maybe you're smelling food cooking, but the eyes continue to read. You know, you're scanning down and you go through two or three paragraphs and suddenly you wake up and realize, oh, wait a minute. And if you go back and reread those two or three paragraphs, they sound familiar. You know, you heard your own voice reading them while all this other stuff was going on, but you didn't actually pay attention to them. What they found is that even though you don't remember anything you read, if there is some figure in there, say the number of senators in his example who voted for campaign reform law, if somebody says, well, just take a guess how many it was, you're very likely to guess the right number, which you read but don't remember. So it's going into the brain, but you're not actually seeing it. But it's there. We're really helpless until we realize that we're not paying attention. When we do, then it's just a question of, are we willing to come back into the present, or would we rather daydream or think about the past or worry about the future? And I guess what I'm arguing here is it's worthwhile having the ability to decide what you're going to pay attention to. It's worthwhile having the ability or the knowledge of how limited your ability is to imagine things and to be able to base your decisions on more data than just the way you feel about something when you imagine it. There's so many things where I just... Here's an example. If I had a nickel for everyone who said, I'm going to come to the center and train, and then didn't show up, I would have several dollars. People say that's what they intend to do, but they're in that situation of predicting what I'm going to do in the future, and we're just notoriously bad at that. You know, at the time I can say, well, maybe you will, maybe you won't. It's surprising how the majority of times people don't. I had somebody recently at Chautauqua who wants to come and train, and you know, in my mind I'm thinking there's a 20% shot that will actually happen. It's actually almost more amazing when somebody actually does show up. Of course, coming to train is not the be-all and end-all. There are plenty of people who also come to a workshop. They join as a member, and then you don't see them again. And going outside the world of Zen, there are all sorts of people who check out the gym, sign up, pay their dues, and then never come and exercise again. There's all the people who have come to the center and moved on to Arnold Park because they want to be as close to the center as possible, and then never come for sitting. It's just, we're just so poor predictors of what we're going to do. It's kind of shocking when you stop and look at it. I have the tires inflated on my bike. I had the idea that all this summer I would be riding it, come home from the center about 4 o'clock, get on the bike, you know, push through any tiredness I have, and I've done that once. And I still intend to do it. And, you know, if I keep working at it, eventually I will. I have some faith that eventually, you know, I can do it. But it's hard. It's not easy. It's worth paying attention to. It's worth seeing what's going on. It's worth revisiting it until suddenly something clicks in the mind. We make this mistake between being aware of what needs to be done, having information about what needs to be done, and being aware of it, really, on a deeper level. And I want to read something by something that people have heard from before, a guy named Anthony DeMello, my favorite Jesuit priest. He says, I want to give you a taste of the difference between analysis and awareness, or information on the one hand and insight on the other. Information is not insight, analysis is not awareness, and knowledge is not awareness. Suppose I walked in here with a snake crawling up my arm and I said to you, do you see the snake crawling up my arm? I've just checked in an encyclopedia before coming to this session and I found out that this snake is known as a Russell's viper. If it bit me, I would die within half a minute. Could you kindly suggest ways and means by which I could rid myself of this creature that is crawling up my arm? Who talks like this? I have information, but I've got no awareness. Or, say I'm destroying myself with alcohol. Kindly describe ways and means by which I could get rid of this addiction. A person who says this has no awareness. He knows he is destroying himself, but he's not aware of it. If he were aware of it, the addiction would drop that minute, and if I were aware of what the snake was, I wouldn't brush it off my arm. It would get brushed off through me. That's what I'm talking about, he says. That's the change I'm talking about. You don't change yourself. It's not me changing me. Change takes place through you and in you. In your awareness, it happens. You don't do it. When you're doing it, it's a bad sign. It won't last. And if it does last, God have mercy on the people you're living with, because you're going to be very rigid. People who are converted on the basis of self-hatred and self-dissatisfaction are impossible to live with. Somebody said, if you want to be a martyr, marry a saint. But in awareness, you keep your softness, your subtleness, your gentleness, your openness, your flexibility, and you don't push, change occurs. Mentions a priest that he knew who said to him, I had all the information I needed. I knew that alcohol was killing me, and believe me, nothing changes an alcoholic, not even the love of his wife or his kids. He does love them, but it doesn't change him. And the priest says, I discovered one thing that changed me. I was lying in a gutter one day under a light drizzle. I opened my eyes and I saw that this was killing me. I saw it and I never had a desire to touch a drop after that. See the same thing with people who suddenly are able to quit smoking when they have the diagnosis of lung cancer. We know it, but we don't get it on that emotional level. We're not aware of it. There's so much else that's sloppy about our thinking. Of course, Buddhism points out the illusory nature of the self. You know, whenever we think about ourselves, we're thinking about an imaginary, fictitious character which we can never find or put our finger on. It's really interesting to me because my granddaughter Isabel has just discovered herself. I have a little video that Sasha sent me with Isabel gaily at the table going, Mommy, Daddy, Isabel! It's cute and sort of terrifying at the same time. That Isabel is going to cause you a lot of problems. You know, even something like this whole, you know, we talk about remembering things from the past and imagining things in the future. What on earth is our sense of time? What do we mean by time? Anytime you try to imagine it, all you can do is convert it into a picture of space. So what they found is people who come from the West, read from left to right, when they imagine events, they put them on a timeline that runs from the left to the right. If you're Arabic, you put it on a timeline that runs from the right to the left. And if you read Mandarin Chinese, you go from the bottom to the top. And yet we do this without even thinking about it. You know, what do we mean by the past? What do we mean by the future? We have all these shorthand devices in the mind which are incredibly useful, but we keep forgetting that they're just crude pictures. They're just concepts. They're just ideas. The danger is that instead of using them as the limited yet useful tools that they are, we end up living in them. And we end up making decisions based on them that get us into trouble. Of course, we have this idea that coming to awakening, practicing Zen for many years, is going to relieve us from these biases, that somehow a Zen teacher sees things more clearly. And that's true. A Zen teacher probably does see things more clearly, but these are not blind spots that go away. They're still there. And one of the things that we've seen recently is, you know, all these revelations of truly bad behavior by Zen teachers. Some of it, you know, far more disturbing than others, but, you know, who wants to get into saying, you know, well, what this person did wasn't as bad as what that person did. But it's just sort of shocking. You see a lot of it with teachers who've come here from another culture, and perhaps there's some problem with their integrating with Western ways, or you know, maybe some of the things they do are more acceptable back in Japan or Tibet or wherever they've come from. But it's still kind of shocking. And I know a lot of people are bothered by this in their practice because you're thinking, well, you know, if these guys who are supposed to be perfect are making all these mistakes and living out of what certainly appears to be selfishness and unrestrained desire, if these guys are doing that, then why should I practice? Why should I follow this path. Remember Roshi Kaplow used to say, the enlightenment doesn't make the man makes the enlightenment. Or we can substitute woman for man there. Back in ancient China, many of the great Zen masters began their careers in the Vinaya school, that is the school of learning all the monastic rules and regulations, the school of morality. And I've come more and more to think that that's really, really important. Having that sort of moral basis really drilled into you before you move into an understanding of the relativity of morality, and before you start to get all the feedback about what a special person you are, and before you're thrust into the teacher role and suddenly have people projecting on you all their ideals for what a perfect person is. It's really, and it's not just Zen teachers, obviously, it's, you know, as Roshi says, clergy of every stripe. Anybody who's put into a position of authority or a position of being looked up at is at tremendous risk. It's what's remarkable is the people who don't succumb in one way or another, and probably everybody succumbs in, you know, to some extent, whether it's just a little bit of arrogance or self-preference. Short of full and complete enlightenment, everyone is biased, and everyone has moments of delusion. The whole scenario of Tiger Woods is just resonates so much. You know, here's this guy who seemed almost superhuman in his ability to, of course, it's just playing golf, you know, hitting a ball around a course, but obviously this is somebody with tremendous powers of concentration and tremendous discipline to maintain his skills, to practice long, long hours. And, of course, the image that he projected was one of a really, you know, thoughtful and integrated person. And suddenly out comes all these stories about unfaithfulness and really just over-the-top sexual acting out. It's kind of endearing now that he's having trouble getting his game back. It makes me think that maybe he's taken some of this stuff to heart. What you often see with people who have great powers of concentration is the ability just to compartmentalize things. You know, people talked about how well Bill Clinton could do that. He could ignore all the seamy stuff that had gone on, his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and attend to the business of the presidency and to negotiating his way through the investigation by Kenneth Starr. Because he was so easily able to put aside all the horrible feelings he must have had from those circumstances. And I think that may be going on with some of these, you know, fairly advanced Zen teachers who are able to take advantage of their students in ways that are just horrific, and yet still continue to be, according to the testimony of others of their students, very effective Zen teachers. But to my mind, that's just not enough. That's not it. That's not why we're doing this. We're not here to become some sort of spiritual athlete, you know, able to get into samadhi more easily than other people. We're here for the sake of all beings, where if what we're doing doesn't lead us to treat other people better, then what's the point? Really, what's the point? I would argue that Zen practice gives us the tools to do just that, but it really depends on our intention. And that isn't something that we can just set and then forget about. You know, circumstances change. All of a sudden, you know, what worked well in the past doesn't work so well now, and we find ourselves in new positions of authority new temptations come up, and really, unless we really put unless at the center of what we're doing is the desire to save all sentient beings, let's just put it that way. If it's not, if there's not a feeling of love for others, it can go wrong so easily, and we can hurt other people so easily. Well, this talk has seemed a little disjointed to me, but at least I think there I've said what I really wanted to get out and to say. We really have used up our time. It's already 10:30, but if anybody has any burning question, maybe we could take one or two before we stop. Okay, let's go with the four vows.